Today is June the 26th, the year 2007. I'm here in Forest Hills, which is a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I'm with Heather Rebick, who came here a few times, at least, and one of those times she was taken to Ellis Island, and that was around when she was 10 years old in 1949. This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm going to let Heather tell her story as to why there's some confusion as to when you arrived in this country. Well, first, if you would just say your birth date and where you were born.
Okay, I was born February 26th, 1939, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada.
Okay, and were you living in Halifax the whole time?
No. As a matter of fact, when I first came over under the strange circumstances I'm about to tell you, I was actually living in a village in Quebec.
Oh.
I'm not a native Quebecan, and of course, obviously it was uncomfortable because I didn't speak French. But for whatever reason, my mother, who was very much more comfortable in Halifax, decided after the death of my father in the war to take us to Quebec, and I have no idea why she did that. And took us to a village called Nitro, believe it or not.
N-I-T-R-O?
N-I-T-R-O, just like nitroglycerin, which I'm assuming was the root word of the village. And we lived there for I don't know how many years. But in any case, my mother and I and my brother, who was 20 months younger than I, lived there probably until about 1949. So we went there when I was probably about 6, maybe 7 to Nitro, because I don't know when exactly I left where I was living.
Let's just say your mother's name.
Okay, my mother was Irene Laura Hubbelt Mackay at that time, because my last name was Mackay after my father, Alexander Mackay.
How do you spell?
M-C, capital K-A-Y.
And your mother's maiden name?
Hubbelt, H-A-W-B-O-L-T.
And your father's name?
Alexander Grant Mackay, and he was from Aberdeen, Scotland.
Oh, okay. And you said he was in the Second World War?
Yes, he was killed in the Second World War.
World War. So
six weeks shy of my 6th birthday.
So do you remember him at all?
Not very much, no.
Any memories at all?
Little ones, but odd ones. I mean, I remember sitting and watching him shave himself, holding the inevitable cigarette out of the corner of his mouth. And I do remember the fact that he was a classical music expert and very well, very articulate. Also so fanatical about his composition of how he spoke. Needless to say, he had a Scottish accent, too. From Aberdeen. He was a chief steward in a boat line, and had a lot of responsibility. And I do remember the fact that any time he wrote notes to my brother or me, sometimes it would take 2 or 3 writings. He was so precise about expression.
How old was he when he immigrated?
He didn't actually immigrate. In fact, he was still a Scotsman when he was flying for Canada. Remember, the Brits were all related.
Oh,
so even though
right.
He lived years in London, he was from Aberdeen, lived a long time in London, then became this chief steward in part of an English steamship line. But he moved. I don't know why he came to Canada. I have no idea why. What brought him there, which is where he met my mother, obviously. He was about 10 years older than my mother. They were married when my mother was 20, and he must have been 30-something when they were married. And as you may or may not know, there was no draft in Canada. It was strictly voluntary. So when he joined the service, which, by the way, was the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, even though he was a Brit, he joined for whatever reason, probably because my mother was there and they were married. Anyway, he joined the RCAF, and that's where he was flying, and obviously that's why he was killed.
So he really volunteered to fight.
Yes.
When he really didn't have
right.
to.
Well, actually, the the whole Second World War thing, the Canucks, anybody from Canada, was known for being ferocious fighters, and they were there because they chose to be there. So, and my dad was obviously clearly a man of extreme concern. I think, number one, at that point, not a whole lot of people knew about the Holocaust. Certainly the governments did, and even the religious groups did to a certain extent, but a lot of ordinary people didn't. But he didn't like the fact that the war was going, or potentially could be going, against what he thought was the right way of living. So I don't think his decision to go to war was popular with my mother, but there wasn't a whole lot that she could do about it. And it certainly ended up not being popular with me, for obvious reasons, because he was killed.
Hmm.
I would have been 6 years old, 6 weeks after he was killed.
Wow. And he was killed flying over...
He was a rear gunner. He was shot down over Germany, and only one person survived. No, nobody else survived.
Hmm.
Their bodies were found and buried, ironically, by a Catholic priest. I say ironically because there wasn't one single Catholic aboard the plane that particular time. But he buried them all in a Catholic churchyard. They've since been reinterred in a British war graveyard, which is where he is now. And
in
Germany.
Uh-huh.
He's still in Germany. The thing, that, in fact, that bothered me about that for years is that I had heard that European burial places were very limited. It's obviously a small place. And that, for whatever reason, some person told me that, in fact, what ends up is that they end up losing their burial place and somebody else gets... He couldn't give me the explanation about what happens. So for years, I agonized over the potential of my brother's or my father's body being lost somehow.
Yeah.
And even though I would love to have actually seen him again live, it was good to know where he ended up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I know exactly the cemetery and everything, so small comfort, I know, but...
Yeah. Wow.
At least I know. My brother was 20 months younger than I, so he was just a little guy when my dad was killed, and it was a very sad time. It actually ruined lots of lives. I'm sure it was extra hard for my mother. My mother was only in her late 20s when it happened. She was very bright, very beautiful, very articulate and all that stuff, but you're still stuck with two kids. I'm sure she didn't say she was stuck with two kids, but the point being she was all by herself. And it's true that the Canadian government was, and probably still is, extremely generous in terms of how they support widows and children. In other words, there's no requirement that mothers are going to have to go to work and find a job, because the various monies sent to the survivors of people killed in the war, at least at that time, were quite generous.
Hmm.
So she wasn't in any financial distress. But why we ended up in Quebec, I have no clue. She at one time had lived in Quebec, but in Montreal, which is a much more sophisticated city. In fact, my brother was born there. But how we ended up in this little village, I have no clue.
Wow.
No clue. Anyway, we moved from there. Went for a time, after my mother married my stepfather, we moved for a time to a house in Montreal with a woman friend of my father's. And she owned the house, but she also rented out rooms. It was actually a beautiful house, and all kinds of room. And from there is where we actually ended up coming to the States, but in a couple of different ways. And I don't know all of them. I just remember I remember two ways, actually. But the upshot was that for many years, I never realized, and by the way, it's been straightened out, that I was here illegally. But I'm here legally now, and I'm a citizen, so that's not going to be a problem.
Okay, good. Well, was your stepfather American?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. And I think, even because I remember hearing discussions between them at the time, a lot of Americans then, and probably to a certain extent now, believe that if they're Americans, they have this huge power to do things that, in fact, legally they can't. And I remember his argument was that because my mother, a Canadian, had married him, that there'd be an automatic, almost citizenship. And therefore, anything else would be conferred on us because we were minor children. Well, of course, that simply isn't true, nor was it true then. And I don't know whether he didn't know the truth about it. My stepfather was an engineer, by the way, if that's relevant, I don't know. But he was an engineer whose job was to build rather interesting buildings all over the country and all over Canada, which is where my mother had met him. So he wasn't a stupid man, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't know when the law changed, but that was true.
Well, up to a point, but he couldn't come in here illegally and have that conferred. In other words, he should have gone through some kind of legal stuff just to take us in here, and he did not do that. And I think it probably was ignorance. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. you know, and certainly, if you are married to an American citizen, your time to wait to become a citizen is shorter than if you come over on your by yourself. But you still have to do the legalities. Mm-hmm. You have to do that kind of stuff before you, you know. And clearly, that's how we ended up going to Ellis Island. Not with any knowledge that for sure that was going to happen, but the surprise was that we ended up in Ellis Island by just flying over to the States.
Okay, so the first time you came, mm-hmm. Which you don't exactly remember did you stay here for a while?
It's hard to just, no, actually we didn't, because the big thing is when we lived in Nitro, one of the things that we did frequently, in fact, is that my mother would take us by train to New York to go to movies. And I know that sounds bizarre, but at one time there was a major disastrous theater fire in Montreal where several children were killed. So legally, it was not, we were not able to go to a movie in Quebec because we were too little. The irony being you could get married, but you couldn't go to a movie by the time you were like 18 or whatever. But so we frequently went back and forth to, but we had the usual papers. There was not a problem. And I don't know whether they extended that or what, but I know when my mother married McLean, who was an American, the assumption was, by him at least, that there would be no problem doing the usual kinds of things. My mother had the paperwork necessary to take us back and forth, but not to reside permanently.
Not to stay.
So anyway, our trip to stay in Montreal after we left Nitro and stayed for a while in Montreal probably was a preliminary to moving to the States. But of course, I was too little to know that. I was probably maybe 8, 9 at the most when that whole thing took place. I was 10 when they were married, and they left. I know I was still living in Nitro at that time because they left me and my brother Pete to fly to Texas to be married. And the reason I remember that I was still in Nitro at the time is because that's where I learned to knit. This lovely woman who was babysitting us taught me how to knit. Well, that's why I remember that so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after that that they, and again, I was 10 years old at that point. And we went to Montreal and stayed with my father's friend, Auntie Flo, we used to call her. Really interesting French woman. But from there, a couple of attempts were made, but nowhere was it presented as a permanent coming to the States. And this whole thing about the Ellis Island landing, remember, I being as young as I was, would not have been involved in any of the discussions about what we're going to do. I know that there were times. I know there were times that there were discussions relative to the legalities of his position in relation to my mother and to us, but I never, obviously wasn't around to hear the final uh-huh. thing. How it was that he was in the States someplace, probably involved in one of the things he was building, was my assumption now is that we were supposed to, after we left New York, because we flew into one of the airports from Montreal to one of the airports in New York, and we were therefore supposed to join him wherever he was at the time. But what interrupted that was, and I don't know what alerted them, but all of a sudden these authorities showed up and said, no way, Jose, and we ended up in Ellis Island, which to this day I've never understood.
Well, now, were you traveling? Was your mother with you?
Yes.
Your mother and your brother?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So you flew into New York mm-hmm. thinking you were going to join your stepfather
wherever
somewhere.
It was. Exactly.
And instead, the authorities said you're illegally here.
Yes, but what I don't understand and never will understand is why weren't we just sent back? Why were we kept at Ellis Island? Overnight only, by the way, and then we went back home.
Okay, so it was 1949. Do you remember anything about Ellis Island?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, good.
Oh, God,
okay,
yes.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, the big thing, of course, was the immense place. The one thing is there were not many people there. And, of course, when they said Ellis Island, I guess I had read something. I'd read everything they got in front of me. They didn't ever put a cereal box in front of me. If I had to go, I would read it. So I read somewhere about Ellis Island, but obviously I had no reason to absorb a whole bunch about it because I wasn't going to Ellis Island. But we were taken into this place. Everybody was very nice to us, by the way, but there was really nobody there, so apparently nobody, no other immigrants were around. And I didn't consider myself an immigrant because I was only from Canada.
Right.
That's not that far. I could walk up across the border. But anyway, they took us, and it must have been, I know there was, it was still light out because I remember they took us to this absolutely huge room. There had to have been 100 beds in there anyway, all by ourselves. There was nobody else in there.
Oh, my
gosh. So that's going to be a good indication of where we were immigration-wise. Anyway, they took us into this room, my mother and I and my brother. My brother's able to detach himself from things much more than I am. My mother looked nervous, but not any more than you'd expect because she wasn't expecting that either. I was terrified. It left me, in fact, with a permanent fear that someday I was going to be sent to jail.
Wow.
To this day, I can tell you that if I were put in jail, I would just lose it. And that was the thing, even though they were very nice to us.
Now, did it have a jail-like...
Oh, yeah, it did. The thing that made a jail-like thing about it was not even the room, although the room size and the beds in it, which, by the way, were beautifully made. I mean, they're all neat.
Were they bunk beds?
Yeah. No, not bunk beds, but the large, like, single-type beds.
Cots.
Like cots. But each one had a blanket and then the whole 9 yards. Excuse me. But at one point, we were shown this room and told to put our stuff down and whatever, and that everything was going to be straightened out. And again, I was just terrified. I was a pretty nervous little kid anyway, but also I was a little girl. Little girls do that. And I could see that my mother didn't know what was going on. My brother was kind of detached, but that's pretty much the way Pete is. Bless his heart. But, I mean, he may be a genius, but he gets detached. But anyhow, at that point, the matron, I guess is what she was, although that's what seemed like it was, someone was a woman and a man were there also. The woman was more involved with us, probably because we were little kids. But anyway, she told us where to put our stuff in that we would be eating soon. Well, my mother said something about, well, we aren't hungry, we don't want to eat. So I'm thinking to myself at the time, and I didn't say anything because she just didn't answer my mother back. You never conferred anything but agreement. And I remember holding my hand up like, wait a second. But I wasn't a great eater anyway, so it probably was just a matter that I wanted to get out of that room, figuring that would be a way to do it. I certainly wasn't hungry. But I remember saying to the woman as she was exiting, and it seemed like we were in the middle of this room because she had to walk ages to get to the door. And I yelled after, I have to go to the bathroom. And she said, well, not now. And I said, but I have to go to the bathroom badly. I mean, I was a little kid. Little kids have to go to the bathroom now. And I said, but I have to go badly. She said, I'm sorry, you'll have to wait. And she left the door, and honest to God, I'm sure she didn't slam it. It was just a big door, but all I heard was this crash sound of the door. So I ran to the door thinking, well, I'm going to... And it was locked. Just absolutely terrified me. And I'm pounding on the door like mad. My mother's looking. She's sitting on one of the beds, and so is my brother sitting on another bed, obviously completely overwhelmed. And my mother didn't get overwhelmed easily. She usually could rise to the fore and do something about whatever. But she, obviously completely unexpected. So I'm still pounding like mad, and of course I start crying. And not long after that, the matron came back. I shouldn't call her. Maybe she's not calling the matron.
I think that
I don't
would
know.
Be appropriate.
But to me,
yeah.
To me it was a matron because it was a jail to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, she came back about, I don't know, a few minutes later, and she said, okay, I'll take you to the bathroom. So, and my mother said, no, you will not take my daughter. I have to go with her. And I understand that from a perspective of not wanting your kid to go anywhere else. And she said, no, you cannot go. So there I was, my mother and my brother are left in this room, and she's taking me where? As it turned out, it was just to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And she just stood at the bathroom and just made sure that I was safe, really. I mean, she was a very nice person. It's just that...
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we went back to the room after I used the bathroom. And then, of course, my mother said, well, what about washing up? What about changing? What about sleeping? Whatever. And the woman said, all of that will have to be done here. And, of course, you look at the back of the room and they had... looked like just sinks.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing elaborate or anything, just a sink and whatever. And my mother said, well, when are we getting out of here? Like, I can't sleep here. And the matron said, yes, you will be sleeping here.
Mm.
So, naturally, and my brother's just telling me, well, I guess I could do that. But he didn't say anything about the meal or anything, and I do not remember eating, which is interesting. So it may very well be that my mother's saying we don't want to eat may, in fact, have involved not eating, because I don't remember anybody coming back, and I don't remember going anywhere to eat. I do remember the next morning waking up, but I have no idea what time, but I remember the next morning waking up with, I don't think it was the same matron. I know it was a woman, but I don't think it was the same woman, because the woman that I'm talking about was a big woman, and I remember this one being much more my mother's size. And she came in and she said, please get your stuff gathered up. Okay. And we went, and all of a sudden we were taken out, and then we were taken back to the airport, and we flew back home.
My goodness. Now, do you think your mother knew what the problem was?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think the big thing, she might have surmised it relative to how this had gone on, but I think that she was buying into my stepfather's belief that, in fact, because he was an American, nothing would be a problem. So I don't know, but it also may be that she just chose not to share it with me because I was a little kid,
mm-hmm.
or with Pete. So,
mm-hmm.
so I actually don't know whether or not she knew. I know there was an argument next time we saw each other, because again, we went back to Montreal to my Auntie Flo's house, and there must have been some conversation that dictated that McLean come back. McLean was my stepfather.
Is that his first name or
no? John R. McLean was his last name.
M.C.
M.C. capital L.E.A.N. But anyway, he was wherever he was, and I think it was Texas, which is where he was, probably working out on something there. But anyway, he ended up coming back because he came back to Montreal, and I remember that there was an argument, but whenever there was an argument, my mother tried to make sure we were out of the room, so I wasn't necessarily privy to that argument. And I'm gathering that I can't be sure whether or not anything was settled in terms of how we were actually going to go back there. But I do remember at one point being smuggled across in a truck at night with a man that had watches all up his arms. And I said to McLean, my stepfather, I said, he's got whole bunches of watches. Why would he have so many watches? And McLean said to me, don't offer to buy any of them. And I said, but they're really nice watches. And he said, Heather, please. So clearly this was the guy running this smuggling thing.
And was this after the Ellis Island
thing? Yeah, this was after the Ellis Island thing. And I don't know, to tell you the truth, I don't know whether this was the final time that we came to the States. That I can't remember. So I don't know whether, in fact, that whole experience was where my illegality truly originated or what, and I did not know I was here illegally. I mean, you figure, I lived in the States, in Texas and Louisiana and Pennsylvania for years, and it wasn't until I was a young mother with a year-old child that the immigration officials showed up at my door and said, guess what, you're here illegally and you're going back to Canada. And it turns out that my brother Pete, who also did not know he was here illegally, had tried to join the Air Force here. And that's when he found, that's literally when we found out we weren't here legally.
Oh my gosh.
It was awful, because then I had to go through this huge problem of, by the way, I had to mention Ellis Island, I had to go through this whole routine of getting all of my facts and everything together in order to present when I went over, I had to literally go back to Canada to straighten out my immigration status, which means I understand what's going on now with the various Hispanic stuff. And because I literally had to go back to get all the immigration stuff straightened out after so much communication. And at that point, I had a year-and-a-half-year-old daughter who was American, obviously, and so was my husband, but I kept being threatened that they were going to make sure I was separated from my daughter and my husband.
Oh,
it was really nasty. I mean, it was truly nasty stuff, and they kept saying, I said, well, you can't do that. I said, number one, I'm her mother. Well, we'll not only separate you, but we'll make sure we'll even take her away from you. Now, they never said anything like that around my husband. They wouldn't have dared. But obviously, that's not legally something that could have been done. But it was just like one more thing they were heaping on the pile of terrible stuff. I know at one point the Ellis Island thing came into question, and I couldn't understand that because I said to, I think it was when I went back to Toronto to straighten things out, but I was at an American embassy, which is where I had to go. And they asked me about Ellis Island. I said, well, number one, how do you know about Ellis Island? Because it's not relevant. I said, that was a here and back, that wasn't part of anything. Well, we wanted to make sure that you actually went back to Canada. I said, I was a little kid. How could I possibly be in charge of where I was going? Well, we just needed to know.
Was your mother alive when the immigration officials were threatening to send?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. But see, at that point, my mother basically destroyed her brain by drinking.
Oh.
And then in fact, she ended up dying of head and neck cancer, but relative probably to the extreme smoking and drinking that she did, and which, by the way, is my nursing specialty, which I think is interesting.
Mm.
But and that's not why I chose it. I already was a nurse in head and neck oncology before my mother got sickness. But she and I had stopped communicating or anything. Her choice, by the way, not mine. And again, I honestly believe that she kind of fried her brain on all the drink.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of this stuff that I would normally have talked to her about,
right,
I didn't have access to that information.
Yeah.
And she, by the way, was also affected by the same thing. She was here, obviously, illegally, as I was. But it didn't have the same impact because she had a lot more money than I did.
Was she threatened to be... Was it threatened to her to be sent back?
No.
When they were threatening
No.
you?
Nope. Because she could buy her way out of it. That's the sad thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
My brother didn't have any, God knows he didn't have any money. So he just went back to Canada and joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. And I stayed here for obvious reasons and decided I would try to straighten out my immigration status. And my mother hired an attorney who could put her in the right connections. She never went back to Canada to straighten everything out. In fact, was here many more years before she finally died in the States. Married to her third husband.
Well, now, do you think it was your brother's attempt to join the Air Force here that tipped off the officials?
Yes, I do. And the big thing is, my brother Pete was extremely apologetic because, of course, he said, I didn't know. I said, well, I didn't know either.
Yeah.
And I said, well, didn't Mom know? And I said, I don't think she did. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know. Although, he was closer to her than I was for whatever reason. And I said, why don't you just ask her?
Did he?
And he didn't.
Hmm.
Because I don't think he wanted to know.
Yeah.
And I understand. I mean, I understand a boy's relationship with his mother is different from a girl's. I understand that, but it pissed me off regardless.
Wow. So, did you get any satisfaction when you're trying to straighten things out at the American Embassy?
No, in fact, the interesting thing at that point to me was this whole thing. They spoke to me because there was a group that took care of just that kind of thing. Anytime there were issues about immigration, that particular group in the embassy. In other words, you didn't talk to people who were just interested in protocol and that sort of thing. You talked to this group, including a doctor and all that kind of stuff, that were just interested in the details about the immigration. But they were not very nice.
Hmm.
And including there was a doctor who literally tried to feel his way up my body, and then finally I told him just to quit it.
Oh.
And he said, well, I have to do this. I said, you do not have to do this. I said, number one, if I had TB, you'd still have to let me into the country, right? Well, yeah, that's true. I said, what the hell are you looking at my leg?
Mm.
Well, okay, and he started signing my papers. But then we went through all of that routine, and we came back over the border, and my husband was staying in the car with our daughter, because, of course, that's a long trip.
So your husband and your daughter were on the American side of the border.
No, they came right across with me, because I wanted to make sure. I knew they couldn't do anything legally to either one of them.
Right.
All the paperwork and everything was perfectly okay with them. They just happened to accompany me, obviously. And on the way back from Toronto, my husband stayed in the car with Mikey, my daughter, and I went in to straighten out all the papers and all, because you had to hand over this mass of papers that had taken me 2 years to acquire. And it was such an ordeal that everything that you turned over to them had to be at least no longer than 6 months old. In other words, if you've gotten a statement or whatever that's a year old, you have to go through the whole thing again. That's police reports and everything from every city that I ever lived in.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you, what did they ask you to provide?
Everything, a history of yourself, and always related to your school and your any police place that you lived. I mean, you have to figure that when I graduated from high school, which is 12 years, right, like 13 years counting kindergarten, I'd gone to 14 different schools.
Oh, no. And so you had to provide from the schools in Canada and also...
Everywhere I'd gone, from the age of 16, I think. The age of 16, because I guess you're more likely to get in trouble at the age of 16 than you are like 12. But anyway, so I had to write to all police departments, and of course I'm thinking to myself, no, is this... This parish is the whole complex idea of counties and parishes and all that kind of stuff, provinces and whatever you get. Well, what is this form here? Is this who paid attention?
Mm.
So I had this mass of papers that were all current and all legal and all that kind of stuff. And I get to this border guard type person, and he looks through my paper, flip, 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 like you know he's not really looking, and he says, just so you know, sometimes this stuff gets lost.
Boy,
I just burst in. I mean, I was just hysterical. I was crying so hard. And I'm normally not a person, and in fact, my mother, you don't lose control in public. You never lose control. Don't ever cry, et cetera. But I just lost it. And I came out crying, because of course I had to leave the papers there, and I'm crying, sobbing. My husband asked me what was wrong, and needless to say, he took matters in his own hands. I thought he was going to kill the guy. He walks right back in. And of course, he at least was an American, as this guy was, and he basically threatened him. And of course, the guy would have had a leg to stand on, because he'd have to understand what had stimulated this threat. Oh, well, we'll take care of whatever. But needless to say, it all had to end up back in Pittsburgh through this whole...
No, wait, where were you
Niagara.
When the guard said that things might get lost?
Niagara.
Uh-huh.
I did the border crossing, maybe on over Niagara toward Toronto. And the only thing good about that was to get fish and chips, but that's irrelevant. But anyway, all the papers that I turned into him, and I'm talking this mass of papers, because even though some of them had expired because of the six-month thing, I put them all together anyway, thinking, well, if you're looking at that, I'm kind of compulsive anyway. But I would put everything relevant to that particular police department or that police station or whatever all together so they would see I've been communicating for all this time. So I've got this pounds of paper that inevitably, I guess, would be somebody would look at it, I'm assuming. But the ultimate fate of it was to go from this Niagara station to be transported back to the immigration people here in Pittsburgh.
Were you and your husband living in Pittsburgh?
Yes.
I see.
Yes. And in fact, in Squirrel Hill.
Oh.
And the point being, of course, that I kept waiting to find out that, in fact, it hadn't arrived. I was scared to death because I thought, I can't go through this again. I just can't deal with this. Plus, of course, I'm still dealing with this threat that my baby's going to be taken away. I know that it wouldn't have happened. Now I know that. But when you have somebody in authority threatening you...
Mm.
You don't know any other way to think about it. I mean, I was only like 21, 22 years old. I mean, I was a kid.
Mm.
And then when I finally got issued an alien number, At least I knew I was safe in that respect. So I waited the, when it was 5 years or whatever, before I applied for citizenship, and that was not a problem, and I did become a citizen, and I am a citizen. But I have a certain sympathy for anybody who's trying to get into support. Whether they have any watches on their arms is beside the point.
So let's see. So you you eventually got all that paperwork sent to you in Pittsburgh?
Yep, sent to the immigration people, and that's why I was issued an alien number. But, of course, you don't know that because nobody calls you and says, guess what, your papers arrived.
How long did it take from the time you were in Niagara?
Months. Yeah, which, again, is a typical thing of the slow speed of anything moving to the bureaucracy that we know and love. Mm. But the point being, there is no way for somebody going through that to ascertain that, in fact, that's what's happening, because if you call, nobody has seen anything. Mm-hmm. It's true they're not saying, okay, you've got to go back again. But by the same token, you have no guarantee that they're not going to come back and say, guess what, you've got to go back again.
Mm.
And I understand. The other thing that bothers me in a way, because the people who have come over from Mexico, who I feel bad for, I really feel awful for, because I understand them better than the average person does. But a lot of people also don't realize that if they come from Guatemala or even from Europe, they don't have to go back. Only countries contingent to the United States borders have to go over.
Have to go back?
Mm-hmm. In other words, you're from Mexico or Canada, you have to go back and straighten out your immigration. You're out further than that, don't worry about it. We'll straighten it by mail. Is that fair? No, it's not. But it also, it does obviously describe what could happen with the, I'm gathering a vast number of illegal immigrants right now are Mexicans. Which means they technically do have to go back to Mexico. A point that I will understand. I didn't agree with it, but I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Except it really aggravated me that why do I have to go back to Canada, but if I'm from England, I don't have to? Just because the border doesn't touch? Is that fair?
Mm.
It just makes no sense to me. At all. Just like any Hispanics that are not literally connected to the country would not have to go back and straighten out. They could do it by mail. But anybody who's here from Mexico, forget it. You're in big trouble. Or if you came through from Canada, same thing. It's just, and every time I hear immigration, I go, this all over again. It bothers me because part of me is not in sympathy. Certainly the part that says the only reason we want these people here is because they work cheaper.
Mm.
I mean, that's exploitation of the person as well as us, the taxpayer. But by the same token, I don't also want anybody to go through what I went through, if it can be done simply, like by mail, and cheaply. It's a whole lot cheaper to have to do that than to go all the way back and all the way back here. And I don't want to spend the money, and I don't think anybody else should.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't want anybody threatened.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, and even that whole Ellis Island, the whole Ellis Island thing, as I said, still to this day has an impact on me. And even in how you think, the whole thing, everybody, I guess, is in sympathy to a certain extent when they release somebody who was in jail when he shouldn't have been.
Like,
they were
right.
convicted and they weren't guilty.
Right.
I have huge, huge sympathy for that, for obvious reasons. Because I think to myself, how would I handle that? All I can remember is that clatter of the door of the Ellis Island room. It was just terrifying.
Do you have any sense of whether you were in a building adjoining the main building, like with that big hall with the balcony? Did it have a balcony around it?
No, I don't remember. The only thing, we were shown, we went through, see, I can't remember how, I know we were taken there by car, obviously, but I remember there was water there. But we weren't in the water, and we were driven by car, and we went in. It seemed like it was a huge building, but I don't remember whether it was anything. But let's face it, it was something that a little kid's not going to necessarily pay attention to. I just remember that there was this mass of hallways that we walked on before we came to this enormous room, and everything, there was nobody there other than these two people who worked there. Just this huge building with these enormous hallways and this room.
See, because there is a small bridge from New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
but I've always been under the impression that it was built when they were restoring the museum, which would have been after.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you went by car, I'm wondering if you went someplace else. Because...
See, I don't remember specifically, but I just remember being in a car, but I don't remember if we went in a car to someplace else. In other words, from the airport, we went into a car.
Oh, right, absolutely.
But
then
remember.
You would have taken a ferry to get
that's
to Ellis.
Probably, yes.
Yeah, probably.
But the thing I remember is being in the car, but I don't remember it being a long trip or anything. I just remember being in a car.
Uh-huh.
I just also remember being so scared, because we had no idea. They didn't say where we were going. They just told us we had to get in the car.
So, wow. Were people nice to you then when they were taking you to Ellis?
They were, but they were kind of officious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as if I'm going to attack them for taking me to this place. And they were not very good as far as information, because I basically was, as a little kid, Bill, where am I going?
Yeah, right.
And over there, whatever. And they did tell me the name. The only reason I remember the Ellis Island is
because they said it.
They said it. And I said, Ellis Island? And I remember saying to them, why are we going there? I absolutely remember asking that and not getting an answer. I don't think they knew why it was
probably
being said
not.
There. So they didn't know how to respond for obvious reasons. And I never will be able to understand why we were taking... I think it's probably somebody screwed up. I don't think we were supposed to be taken there at all. I think we probably should have been put on a plane back.
Plane back, right. Did so you didn't meet like with a legal type at Ellis Island?
No. And the big thing was this huge room, and I don't remember eating, so I don't think we ate. Most of my mother said, "Free, we don't want to eat." Wait a minute. And I do remember that room, that huge room, had these couple little sinks, and the water was running. And I also remember that it was clean.
Hmm.
I also remember that every bed was made precisely, almost in a military fashion, the old bouncing your coin on it routine. And I actually remember also the fact that my mother, for whatever reason, had chosen a room that I swear to God, if you measured, it was precisely in the middle of this one row. And naturally it was going to be, well, which one am I supposed to take? Well, what if I was slightly off-center? But I remember the sinks because at one point, after I'd gone to the bathroom, and this whole routine about washing up, I'm thinking to myself, well, that must mean when we drink our water. So I went over, and there were actually, like, cup things there. I remember that because I remember drawing the water, and I also remember thinking to myself, I can't wash in this little sink, because, of course, I was a bath person, you know. I can't wash in this little sink, God forbid. And I don't remember washing that night, which is interesting, but I remember getting water from the tap.
Mm.
So obviously everything was turned on, but I also remember the enormous size and the beautifully made beds. I mean, they were luxurious beds,
right.
But the precision of the place, it was just like, that must have been whatever they brought anybody questionable, like we must have been, that's where they took them, although not another group came in while we were there.
Well, I'm thinking that you may have stayed in the building that the Coast Guard used
mm-hmm.
when they were stationed there during World War II.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's just what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And that would account for the military mm-hmm. kind of look of the beds and the and
that many beds
and there's
in the
a
room?
Huge building with
yeah.
that they used with a lot of beds in it.
Interesting.
So, I think that would be... The other possibility is that they did intern enemy aliens during World War II. Italians, Germans, and Japanese were probably using that building.
Isn't that interesting?
But you said a few little things about your mother over the course of this, mm-hmm. but how can you say any more about either her temperament, her personality, and... anything about how she dealt with all of this?
The interesting thing is that she was atypically responding.
Oh.
And the reason I say that is, as I mentioned to you before, my mother was very bright, very well read, very articulate. If you had offended her or pissed her off in any way, you would have heard it. And she didn't react that way. And I guess I kept expecting her. But I think what she was doing is that... I think she was being cautious, not wanting to anger somebody that may have some ramifications. It may not have been a true thing, but I think this was so completely overwhelming. Clearly she wasn't expecting this or anything remotely like it, and she didn't know how to explain it to us. She could see us standing there looking at it like, duh, what's going on? And part of her didn't know what to respond to, and I think the other part was caution. Because the very fact that she didn't ream somebody out bespeaks that emotion. I just think, number one, she did look a little bit worried for obvious reasons, because I think literally nobody told me, at least not around me, not around all of us, that other than the one woman said, well, you'll be leaving tomorrow. But other than that, we hadn't heard any time thing. And I think she might have had the same thing that I did, that it was a jail. And I think she also might have been very angry at McLean, because technically he would have been responsible for this whole thing being put in place. Not that he would have known where, I think he was assuming we'd just be scooting through. The other thing I don't understand is, where were we supposed to go after the airport? Was there anything planned? Was somebody supposed to pick us up? Were we supposed to fly someplace else? I don't know.
So what happened when you left?
We just went back to Montreal, the same airport there that we had left from to go to New York. And we went to, I said, this woman friend of my father's who desperately wanted to adopt my brother Pete, but not me. She just wanted a little boy is the only thing. She had no children at all. She said, she was really interesting.
Yeah, say something about her. What was
she was really interesting. She actually, her name was Flo, and I remember making a huge error one time for some stranger. She wasn't comfortable around little kids because she had no children. In fact, she actually wasn't married. She was living with the most interesting chef. He was a French chef from one of the major restaurants in Montreal. And as you, if you know anything about Montreal,
yeah,
that's a pretty big deal. So, anyway, he lived in this house. It was a huge house that she used as a rooming house, but she was a fanatical woman about, I mean, everything was so tidy and so precise and everything. And most of them were single men that lived there. I don't know where they worked, and it wasn't important for me to know, but anyway, every once in a while then she would start a conversation with us, and she was French, but she spoke English, obviously. And I remember her broaching the subject about names one time. And I thought to myself, why does she want to know this, you know? Because again, she had met my dad when he was in the shipping thing. And I don't know the exact details. I mean, they weren't romantically involved. They just were friends. But she asked me one time about names. And she said, what's your favorite name? And I said, I don't really have a favorite name. I said, I don't like my own name, but it's, you know. And she said, well, what do you think about the name Florence? And I remember saying, oh my God, that's a terrible name. And she said, Heather, that's my name. I said, your name's Flo. It's the nickname. I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. To this day, I can't hear the name Florence that I don't think that. Talk about stepping on toes.
Well, maybe that's why she used Flo. She didn't like it either.
But I had a laugh because ever after that, I would just be so apologetic when I would be everywhere. And she didn't expect that. It wasn't that. She was just curious. Because she wanted to know Alex, that's my father's kids better, since she didn't know any of us.
Well, it's kind of a nice thing to do with a child, like what's your favorite
yeah,
name, what's your favorite color,
yeah,
what you know. Yeah.
And I fell right into it. Don't ask me a question you don't want to know the answer to, I used to say, and it's still pretty relevant. Because you'll hear the answer. Whether you like it or not, you can judge later.
Well, now, when did you meet up with your stepfather after that incident?
I don't know, and the reason I say I don't know is because, no, actually, it had to have been. He had to have flown back from wherever he was, where we were supposed to go, because we weren't back in Montreal for long before and we were eating out in a really odd like hotel restaurant kind of thing, not in Montreal. It must have been some place that McLean knew from when he was building the atomic plant, by the way, is what he was building, right? Even though it's the middle of Quebec, that's what he was building when my mother met him. But anyway, he evidently knew this restaurant thing from when he was working there. So he, and he liked the food, and it was very traditional French food. So we were eating at that place, and it became obvious that the symptoms that I had been having for days, which I kind of failed to tell my mother about, were getting more and more serious. So she calls our pediatrician, who, believe it or not, came to this dining room to examine me. Hmm. And I remember being stretched across two chairs, mortified. I was this unbelievably dignified little 10-year-old. Anyway, I remember being examined on this and being sent to the hospital in back at Valleyfield, which was the city right outside of Nitro, but it was the only real hospital that apparently was close by. And I had an emergency appendectomy in a French-speaking hospital. Only one nun could speak English. I had a fairly good command of French at that time, just because that's what I used while I lived in Nitro. But McLean was there then. What we did then was I left the hospital after X number of days, after I had pneumonia too, and went back to Montreal to stay with my Auntie Flo in the same house. And I know McLean was there, but I don't know whether that's where I went. I know I had to stay there for a while, just obviously to recuperate from the surgery. And so it must have been weeks. And I remember McLean was there during that time.
As were your mother and brother.
Yes, right. And then, and I stayed with Auntie Flo while they would do whatever they were doing, so I wasn't conscious of what else was going on as far as the social life of my mother. But I know that at that point, there was never the intention for us to stay there permanently in Auntie Flo's house. It was strictly a Passover kind of thing. We were going to be there as long as, and then we were going wherever. And I don't remember whether that's where the Watches man was contacted. The thing that amazes me, and still does now, and the more I thought about that, the more amazed I get. McLean obviously knew how to contact somebody. Where else? You don't just go in the phone book and say, "Man with Watches, will you transport my family across the border?" Isn't that crazy?
And it's kind of funny that that would have been attempted after you were sent back.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that was the attempt that did it or whether some subsequent just driving over the border thing did. I just know now, of course, later, that it was done illegally. But I don't know whether that particular time. I remember being in this truck, like a moving type truck, big, huge truck. And I remember sitting in the actual back of the truck. And it's not a real comfortable ride, being in the back of the truck.
It was a closed-in truck?
Yeah, closed-in truck.
And was your mother and brother and you in the back of that truck?
And McLean was not there, obviously. He had made the arrangement, and I think he was going in his car across the border, but I don't know what the meeting spot was supposed to be. The presumption was we would go across the border, get out of this truck, and then go into his car to go where?
Did anybody check the back of the truck?
No.
No.
But again, you have to wonder when you go through situations like that about the payoff situation. Was this guy a regular person that did that kind of thing, and therefore the bucks were there? Through McLean, obviously. The thing
and the border guards, too, because they had to...
Absolutely. Right. I mean, wouldn't you naturally want to check on... Especially if you even walk across one of those trucks and you hear, it sounds empty. They weren't moving furniture, obviously, and we were the only people in the truck. I remember that. It wasn't like a whole
bunch
of
people. Yeah.
Like a whole mass immigration, but by the same token, I remember the watches mostly because to this day, I think to myself, it's so blatant. And also, McLean knew that.
Yeah.
Clearly, he's the one that made the arrangements. And clearly he knew about the watches, that this guy was an all-bunch crook. Did he know about the whole Ellis Island? Did he know that it was really not the way he said it was going to be? I don't know.
Yeah. So, but how long did you stay, did your mother stay married to him then? Was she married to him until you grew up?
I was couple of days out of graduation from high school. And I was older, believe it or not, after stripping all those grades and everything, I ended up being 19 years old when I graduated from high school. So naturally, I was asked what grade I'd failed, which in fact, I did not fail any. In fact, I skipped the second and never finished the fourth. Eventually, I finished it, but I didn't actually finish the fourth. I actually was a bright little kid, fortunately, because you think if I'd been dumb, it would have been awful. I mean, I'd probably still be in high school.
Well, you had been in a lot of different schools.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
The only reason I was skipping the second grade because the teacher then said there's no way she belongs in the second, once I get through the first grade. But then the fourth grade thing is, and you wonder about the irresponsibility of parenthood, the reason I never finished the fourth grade is that I started it a couple times and they just never quite stayed in the city long enough for me to finish it. And I went to another city to start the fourth grade, and fortunately, whoever was in charge, I think the principal, was talking to me, and he said, you know, see the bright little girl, there's no way she belongs still in the fourth grade. So he said, let's try her in the fifth grade. Well, not only did I have no trouble in the fifth grade, I ended up grading papers for the teacher. So the shame to me was that I'd lost that time and ended up having this, you know, problem. But anyway, getting back to when McLean was gone, he deserted us. I don't understand why he adopted us. He legally adopted us 3 years after they were married. Not something I wanted, because I didn't want to be separated from, even though I was obviously separated from my father, I didn't want to have the final name thing. And we never called him father or dad. We always called him Daddy Mac, just as a concession thing. But mm-hmm. I never believed that he was my father. He was a nice guy, by the way. He never did nasty things to us. Right? Mm-hmm. That was never the mm-hmm. issue. And they did have a son together. Well, technically two sons together, except I'm not sure about the paternity of the fourth child. But I know that he was Ron's dad. Ron committed suicide when he was 19, mm-hmm. which was devastating to me. Doug, the youngest of the kids, is just a mess, period. But anyhow, I was 2 days after graduation from high school, and he just disappeared. I mean, took every last dime out of the bank, everything, all the clothes, everything, took his car, obviously. And the thing is, I had no idea where he was, but I always got the feeling that my mother did. Oh. And I don't know why she bothered doing it. And she ended up continuing to be married to him until she met the guy that turned out to be her third husband, and then got divorced. And even that, you wonder, how can you divorce somebody that you can't find them? You do have to find a certain, because the 7 years hadn't elapsed out of that, whatever that mm-hmm. thing is. So the whole issue, number one, I don't know exactly why he decided to leave, except that she could be very abusive. Very abusive. And it's possible that that's what finally did. The interesting thing about the school, you know, he was not only not Catholic, but was definitely anti-Catholic. And yet he's the one that made sure I went to this particular school.
Hmm. Well, maybe it was a good school?
It was a very good school. But the big thing is, I had gone, when we moved to Pittsburgh, under circumstances that will always be suspicious to me, but that's beside the point. Anyway, I'd gone, we were living in a hotel downtown, because we had just arrived in town. And the only school available was across what is now the North Shore, although we call it North Side. There was a high school over there that I had enrolled in. It was the only one around. And I came back the first day I enrolled, and I was describing my experience, and I said, they laughed at me when I said, sir or ma'am. Now, I'd lived all these years in the South. You don't say just whatever, you have to say sir or ma'am after you finish. And I said, they laughed at me. And McLean said, they laughed at you? Yeah. So the next day, I go to get up to go to school, and it's 10 o'clock, and I'm just panic-stricken. My God, it's, you know, whatever, why didn't you wake me up? And my mother said, you aren't going to that school. Your father's, she always called him my father, even though I didn't consider my father, has arranged for you to go to another school. So I was in this school for 2 years, my last 2 years of high school. I was in Our Lady of Mercy Academy. And 2 days after graduation, he disappeared. They had a stormy marriage to begin with. They both were basically alcoholics, which didn't help. His thing, my mother always said he learned to cook in prison, which may or may not be the case. But the big thing about it, of course, is the amounts he cooked. He was a very good cook, by the way. But you would, if you came into our house, you could literally choose what you wanted to eat. He would cook every Sunday. He would cook. I mean, we never had a day that goes by that we didn't have at least turkey or chicken, a whole roast thing, beef roast, pork roast, this whole mass of food. And my mother, who actually was a good cook, when I remember as a little kid, she never cooked. Well, of course, why should she?
Yeah.
But she always teased them about what they... Well, she teased them. I think it was a nastier thing than that. And it might be that she was implying maybe he was a former prisoner. I don't know. I'll never know. I don't know anything about it. I didn't even know what his birthday was.
Right. So. Wait, I'm going to pause here because we've done an hour.
Okay.
And put this on because I want to... also ask you something else.
Okay.
How did you happen to come to Pittsburgh? Do you know?
I have no idea. I do not know. The big thing is, this, God, it sounds like I'm married to a bunch of, got involved with a bunch of crooks. My place of residence where I came from was Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My father was building, well, actually, I went to two or three different schools even in Baton Rouge. Went to Baton Rouge, and at one point he went to rebuild the large mental institution that was Louisiana's major thing in Mandeville, Louisiana. So we transferred to Mandeville to live, and we transferred in such a time that it was at the end of the school year, but too late in the school year to transfer to Mandeville. So fortunately, Louisiana's driving laws, I was 15 when I had a driver's license, so I drove my brother Pete and me back to Baton Rouge to finish school. And then we stayed there, and then we started in Mandeville School. And all of a sudden, there was I honestly don't believe it. Number one, McLean wasn't a thief. But somebody cooked up the thing that he had somehow stolen money from this whole thing with the Mandeville construction thing.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And I don't believe it. I think it was all a political thing that somebody else did steal, but it wasn't McLean. Number one, he didn't handle the money. He was the
right.
Contracting chief. He was literally building it. So, I mean, he was in charge of subcontractors and all that, but he just wasn't a thief. He had a lot of other problems going, but thievery wasn't one of them. But anyway, I think that was probably part and parcel of the reason that we left, because we came back to Baton Rouge, and I finished school that year at Baton Rouge. And
let me just ask you, you weren't saying Vanderbilt. What was the name of the...
Mandeville.
Mandeville.
Mandeville, Louisiana. And but anyway, we came back to Baton Rouge, and I went back to school then, and then McLean just left the house we were living in then. Not desertion or anything, and I had no idea where he went. And I gathering that my mother did, but I think everybody was being secret about it relative to this... theft.
Mm-hmm.
I know at one point he spent the night in jail, but that was all.
Mm.
But he was never tried or any of that kind of stuff, which was all really, you know, strange.
Yeah.
Why he went to Pittsburgh, I don't know. But shortly after that, so did we.
So you were like reunited with him in
yeah,
Pittsburgh?
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But I also don't understand how... Now, the hotel that he had us roomed in is gone now, but by the same token, there was obviously not a shortage of money, because they had a double room suite. My brother and I each had our own rooms.
And did you live in the hotel for a while?
Oh yeah, we lived in there for about 6 months, maybe.
Uh huh. And roughly, what year would that have been?
I was 17 years old. So in the 50s someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
56 maybe, something like that. Anyhow, it was shortly after, about 2 or 3 years after we'd been adopted. Again, I never understood the adoption routine, although I've questioned it since to wonder whether or not, since there was a settlement from the Canadian government when that happened, several thousand dollars, whether that wasn't the stimulating factor. And that sounds terrible to say that, but you have to wonder. You have to wonder, because they knew that I didn't want to be adopted. Not that that was mattered, because it wasn't my vote. But it just wasn't my choice, and I don't know why they got otherwise. And let's face it, at that point, we'd been living together like 3 years. Why all of a sudden was it important?
Hmm.
But I'll never find that out, obviously.
Yeah, right.
It was actually always my dream, by the way. The rather significant separation of my mother and me, which, to tell you the truth, I do not understand. I was absolutely the best kid in the world. I was so scared of losing that. I never did nasty things. I never did anything that was worrisome. I never slept with God. Nothing like that. I was kind of the perfect kid because I was scared to be otherwise, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a big moral factor anyway, because the right and wrong thing is very important to me, but I think it was more the idea of what I'd lose if I did something wrong. So that can't have been the reason that we ended up being enemies.
Hmm.
I know that my brother's suicide certainly didn't help. He was only 19 at the time, and he was just the dearest. He was such a good kid. But the thing that I'm relatively confrontational. If I suspect something, I need to know that I'm right or wrong. I just need to know. And at one point, probably about a year after Ron had been born or had died, I was on the phone with my mother, which was rare, but they were trying to get us to pay for Ron's funeral, if you can imagine that. He was like, see, Charlie was probably a millionaire, and I was certainly not. And they were living in a beautiful house in Mount Lebanon. I was not.
Charlie was your mother's
third husband, yes. Real total bastard. But anyway, at one point I said to Mother, you have to understand that I always knew you didn't love me. And there was this so-called pregnant pause in which she said, how did you stand it?
Yeah.
It confirmed for me that I was right.
Mm-hmm.
But so painfully, and I never understood it. But I always used to think up to that point that we'd have a chance to talk and figure out what was going on,
mm-hmm.
and sort this mess out. Well, obviously that never happened. My mother died in the Carolinas, in a very nice area in the Carolinas, and the most beautiful funeral I've ever been to in my life. I guess because it's just the standard thing. It's down at Southern Pines, where all the golf thing is. I mean, it's a major golf type thing. And the big thing is, it is a small town. And the body is taken from the funeral home to where they're going to be buried, obviously. But on each intersection is a cop with the flashing lights and everything. And as the car passes by, it's part of the ceremony of the people who live there.
Oh.
So I think, number one, I think naturally I see the car, I think, oh my God, what do we do? I'll go back to Ellis Island.
Yeah.
And find out that that's just part of their send-off to the citizens.
Wow.
Boy, this is really neat. This is really neat, although I was not made a huge part. My brother Pete, who also was a pilot, flew me down there because I didn't know how else I was going to get there. My husband and I were going through a financially stressful period, and I had no clue about how I was going to be able to afford. I was working, but I was the only one that was working at that point. After he had a very successful career, suddenly he didn't have a job and no chances of getting one because of his age. And so I didn't feel comfortable, number one, just buying a plane ticket. And given the odd relationship we had, I almost couldn't justify it. So Pete called me and he said, do you want to go there? And I said, yeah. So he bought me the ticket to take me down to Raleigh. And then from Raleigh, he picked me up in his plane and we went down to Southern Pines, I think is the name of it. Because he just wanted to make sure I was there. And I think it all goes back to my brother being told when my dad left for the final time, as it turned out to be the final time, you take care of your mother and your sister, which is a very European thing to do.
Yeah.
Much more European, I think, than it is American. American men realize that that little kid's not going to be able to take care of, but it's a very European thing to do, I think.
And he took it to heart.
Yeah, I think he's taking it literally. I mean, there's obviously there are many times where he doesn't come to the fore in terms of the support, because he's not, he has a lot of emotional edges that were never finished off. Mm-hmm. There was no way to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, his father was dead and his mm-hmm. stepfather was yeah. iffy. And he tries the best he can up to a point, but he's probably the world's worst father. He really screwed up his marriage, although she's now divorced from him, but always said I would divorce my brother before I divorced my sister-in-law. I love my sister-in-law, my former sister-in-law.
Mm.
And I've got a new one that I haven't met yet, but...
Mm. Well, now, you married young, right? You married around 18?
I was 20. And I was a mother the first time at 21, but not for the second time until I was 30.
Oh.
I only have two children. That many years apart.
Uh-huh. Daughters. Great. Well, do you want to say your daughter's name?
Sure. Well, the older daughter is Michelle, always called Mikey, and she lives in Las Vegas. She has two beautiful grandchildren. There they are. She's married to an engineer who's involved in a lot of the construction that's going on in Las Vegas, although they're at this point contemplating a move to California. She also is an RN, as I am, and works in oncology as I did, although hers is a general oncology as opposed to my specialty, which was head and neck. Generally a happy person. My younger daughter, Dana, also an RN, lives in Michigan with her husband, has just had a brand new baby, girl, in January. She works at the Michigan Medical Center in cardiology. Her husband works for the Ford Motor Company, where he was recruited from the Pitt MBA program, which he finished here.
So you've stayed in Pittsburgh really pretty much ever since.
I actually love Pittsburgh. I think it probably, for whatever reason, was the city that I finally could come home to, having lived in so many different places and hating to move. I mean, obviously, you don't move that many times as a kid, without realizing that don't bother making friends because you're not going to have them next year. It's not that I wasn't easily befriended, because I was. People actually liked me. And I liked them. It's just that I always was very mm-hmm. reserved.
What was it about Pittsburgh that you really
know.
Liked?
I don't know. And I'm a huge Pittsburgh booster. I absolutely love this. I know it's got problems, et cetera, but there's just something... And it hit me when I first moved, and I don't know why.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why, and I've lived in a couple of major areas of it, other boroughs. In fact, I lived in Squirrel Hill for 20 years. And the only place that I would consider moving to was Forest Hills, which is where I live now. I've lived here not quite 23 years. And again, as far as boroughs go, I love this borough, but it's like an old-fashioned 50s borough.
Oh, nice.
It's just an odd borough. It's like different from all the other boroughs that I know of, but...
And your husband?
My husband his original place. He was born in Braddock, which is from around here.
You married in Pittsburgh,
yes.
A Pittsburgh person?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep.
Great.
My husband's situation was, my husband is the youngest of his family. All of his siblings, but one sister, are dead now. He's the baby. He was 5 years old when his mother died and 7 years old when his father died.
Hmm.
And his one sister, the one that survives, is the one that, God bless her, decided to give up her life, really, and raise him.
Wow. And what's your husband's name?
Thomas.
Thomas Reading.
Anthony Reading, yes.
Okay. Well, what has given you a lot of satisfaction when you think back on your life?
I think probably other than being a mother, because I love being a mother, but I think the nursing career I had a very rewarding one, in the sense that I've had so many patients tell me how important I was to them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them still communicate with me, believe it or not, and I've been out of service for years, involuntarily retired is what I call it. I'm retired involuntarily due to significant multiple sclerosis, and obviously you can't do a whole lot about that. But I think the big thing that I like the fact that I have authored. I've got a book chapter. I've been mentioned in a couple other books as being important sources of information. I wrote a Nursing Journal column for years till I just got tired of doing it. But I liked the fact that the most important thing about what I did as a nurse was that I made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Which, let's face it, in life, that's the best thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Just making a difference. And I think the idea that I must have made some difference, because I asked my daughters, because of course you come home bitching and moaning about a different day and everything that you've had. And I've worked in all kinds of units, including ICU and CCU and the OR, etc. But I asked them one time, why did you choose to be a nurse? You must have heard me. And my older daughter in particular said, all I can tell you, Mom, is, yeah, of course you bitched, whatever. But all I can tell you now about that decision was that you seem to be satisfied and happy more times than you were the other way.
Mm,
and I asked Dana why. I said, well, why you? With a 9-year difference in age, I would think that you would have caught on that this isn't always an ideal place. And she said, Mom, all I know is that you liked what you did. You didn't necessarily like the people you worked with, which was true, especially my last job. I worked in the chairman of the otolaryngology department office for the last 7 years, and he was just a bastard. Just a real bastard. I mean, a very successful, world-known bastard, but he was a bastard regardless. And the one that I worked directly for, who's since gone, was technically a mean guy, although he was just the most ingenious surgeon you could ever be around. And we still communicate by email as far as that goes, but I had a lot of trouble with him because, as I found out later, he had no clue what nurses actually did.
Mm.
He was from New York. He'd actually come from Czechoslovakia originally and done his training, most of his training here, ended up having his main practice in New York. And he was a combination of a laryngologist and board-certified plastic surgeon. And everything he did was just, oh my God, he just truly was a genius. I know the word genius is thrown around all over the place, but he did once confess to me, though, that he didn't understand exactly what nurses did. And I said, well, that was very evident. And he said he just wanted me to know, which was interesting, because he had actually at times been so basically cruel, I'm going to turn that off if you can, that he actually made me cry.
Mm.
In front of people, and he would make these awful remarks.
Wow.
And I accosted him with the information. I said, I'm really. Actually, at one point, I said to the boss that was a bastard, I don't want to work for this guy anymore. It's that simple. And which would have been embarrassing, obviously, for the practice, this whole large group of well-known doctors, but. In fact, one of the doctors I worked for was Nancy Snyderman's brother, who is just a doll. He's just a sweetheart, and so is she a sweetheart, by the way. But the big thing here, though, is the idea that he said at one point, he said, I just want you to know that I was the luckiest person in the world to be able to have you work for me.
Uh-huh.
Then I said to him, and when did you come to that conclusion? Of course, he started to laugh at that point, but I think his wife talked him into it. His wife is just the dearest person in the world. Oh, my God, I just love her. Which is unusual to talk about. For some strange reason, not all, obviously, but a lot of doctors' wives live their lives through the doctor. They even say the doctor when they talk about them instead of my husband or Jim or whatever. And but Cheryl, Jonica, is... She's just terrific, and I always have to laugh every time I say anything. People look like, what is she going to say next? but it's true of her. It was true of virtually all the wives of the doctors that worked in that group. I liked all of them.
Well, so. It's about Pittsburgh a little bit. Has it changed a lot since you've been here? And in what ways?
Yeah, I think it has, but I think it's changed positively. And I say that because when I first came here, and again, it might have been my perception, my juvenile perception of it, I don't know. But at that time, it seemed much less sophisticated than it is now. I think the process was in motion then to make it a little bit more European even, or even like New York. There is nothing here that indicates when it happened. They talk about the so-called Renaissance years, which were like in the 60s. And to a certain extent, you see that in what was done in terms of theater and music and that sort of thing. I mean, we're talking about an orchestra that was asked by the Pope to present. I mean, that's the kind of thing, the theater. That every, in other words, everything here in Pittsburgh, in many respects, is the equivalent of New York, even though you think, there's no way, Jose. Well, that's actually true. And when I first moved here, it was kind of a large, small town. It was much bigger, population-wise, when I first moved here, which kind of breaks my heart that the people are leaving. And I don't understand why they're leaving, but it's a jobs thing. There are no jobs. That's why they're leaving. And
well, the mills were operating when you first came.
They were, but they're not anymore.
Right.
And so many other things are gone. A good indication of that moving thing was my son-in-law's moving after he got his MBA. Why did he have to move out of Pittsburgh? And he didn't move voluntarily because he'd be here if they didn't have to move. But when you're recruited by Ford and you don't have another job, duh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's as for me, of course, there are not a whole lot of cities in the United States that are better equipped for medicine. It's a major medical center and has been for years. So I didn't have to go anywhere to meet that demand. My husband's job was when he ended up being fired because he was too old all of a sudden, only the second top producer in the country, that's incidental. He worked for Sony Corporation and was a major producer for them, and all of a sudden he was gone.
Wow. Well, do you think, are you glad you immigrated? Glad you immigrated?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Why on each side?
Well, the big thing about it is, and I think a lot of it has to do with the politics of now. I know this, I've been here for years, but I think that you watch what's happening now. The Bush administration is just, to me, an absolute disaster. And he is, obviously, and Cheney is, and whatever. But the big thing is you think to yourself, well, eventually they'll say, and then you get a thing like today's report about the Supreme Court just going, of course, any way he wants. And you think to yourself, they're just going to keep chipping away. And that's pretty scary, because apparently we have no recourse, even though theoretically we do. They keep calling this a democracy, but in fact it's not. It's a republic. And in fact, if it had been a democracy, that whole thing with Florida would never have happened. They would have had another election. The bad end thing with Ohio in this last election, that wouldn't have happened either, because you would have had another election. So don't even give me that crap about making sure the Middle East is a democracy. We aren't. So that kind of bothers me. On the other thing being, of course, you think to yourself, well, things have been changed in the past. Maybe they'll happen again. But it just seems now like a huge cancer, and nobody even knows how deep it is. So therefore, how do you begin the approach of healing when you don't even know how deep to dig? You know, I realize it's a cancer metaphor, I understand that, but by the same token, it is a cancer metaphor to me. As far as its relationship to Canada, there have been several things wrong, obviously, in Canada, and in that sense, whatever connection I have with them, all my relatives are basically Canadians and still are there. But that's not necessarily the draw. Because the other draw, of course, would be any ones that I have in Scotland, and people I've never met. People I'd like to meet, obviously. But the big thing is, there are lots of things about the Canadian philosophy, including the healthcare thing and the medicine thing, all that stuff, that you think to yourself, it can be done. Why isn't it being done here? You know?
Yeah.
My sister-in-law, who, of course, is Canadian, the one I love, the one who was married to my brother, has just moved back to Canada, or will be moving back in Canada, for the very simple reason that she needs the health care. That sucks. That really sucks. I mean, why is she having to move back to Canada, for God's sake, when she had a life here? Her job was transferred to some other country. So she lost her job. She's a very able person. She's French-Canadian and actually speaks greatly. But the fact that she's forced because of health care issues, Duh. I mean, we have this huge mass of ability. And I think I became more conscious of it because I worked in them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, you just know these things can happen. And in 1992, because I was the clinical coordinator for the Center for Cranial Base Surgery here, actually that's how I retired too, we had an international meeting in Mexico. The doctor I worked for was the chief of the skull base group, the international skull base group, and he decided he wanted me to go with him. He also decided I was supposed to write a book chapter in his book, which I did. And it was very good, I might add. I was very pleased with it, even though I didn't want to write the damn thing because he wanted me to have it. But anyway, what surprised me was anytime any of the doctors would stand up starting whatever presentation they were giving, they always precluded it with, I don't know if this is how they do it in Pittsburgh. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
That's how big skull-based surgery was from Pittsburgh, all over the world. And I, on the other hand, in this meeting, would be stopped by people who wanted to know exactly what it was that I did in relation to this center. And they weren't all nurses. A lot of them were doctors who were establishing their centers and whatever, and they wanted to know, what exactly do you do for Dr. Jonica? That's why I described.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and then when I talked to Jonica about this, he said, that's why I wanted you to write the chapter. Well, they may not read it. Yes, they will. Because he was the editor of this particular book. But it tells you, though, what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
When you see that much possible in just medicine, and you even talk about, even let's go with the sports teams routine. The Steelers, there are fans all over this country who've never seen the Steelers. They just are Steelers fans, even though they're football teams in their cities. Why? I don't know. The baseball team, let's not even start with that one. And also the hockey team. I'm a hockey, big hockey fan. I'm not a football or baseball mm-hmm. fan, but I'm a major hockey fan. But I especially love the Penguins. But there's just odd little things like that that are a part and parcel of an internationally recognized center along with this other folksy stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is also now being shared by people all over the place.
Wow. Well, I think maybe that's a good place to end.
Okay.
On a high note about Pittsburgh.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope you get back here to visit. I think if you did it more often, you'd love it.
Yeah, okay. Well, I want to thank you. I'm speaking with Heather Rebick, and this is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, signing off.